a word they say, and you're haunted by the swords they raise. Like a rabid dog we've seen before, they refuse to hear the world pounding, pounding down their door.
We don't want your war.
Let's all yell a little louder now.
We don't want your war.
All stand together tall.
We don't want your war.
You keep telling us, you keep telling us we do. The king has no clothes, so he leads by fear. We must challenge all the lies we hear. The devil's bombs has an oily smell, frames a legacy with infamy. He burns it into hell.
We don't want your war.
So yell a little louder now.
We don't want your war.
All stand together tall.
We don't want your war.
But you keep telling us, you keep telling us we do. Try to turn us into lemmings with their magic on TV. Will we all be proud, or will we be ashamed of our leadership? Greedy and arrogant, and we'll all be judged by the choices that we made.
We don't want your war.
Returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice, I'm Steve Lerman. Coming up next is Greenpeace co-founder Robert Marinin shares his story with David Michael Swanson. Robert Marinin is one of the many co-founders of Greenpeace. In this interview, Rod talks about his early activist years before Greenpeace, establishing the now world-renowned organization fighting nuclear testing, Arctic oil drilling, and the dangers he faced as a radical activist. You can hear this program at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area, or go to accesssacramento.org, or download it from greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
I'm your host, David Michael Swanson. This week, I'm speaking with activist Rod Marinin, lifelong activist, co-founder of Greenpeace. Sure you heard of it, global environmental organization doing lots of radical things around the globe to make sure that Mother Earth is protected. Rod co-founded Greenpeace in the early 70s when he was still in his 20s and spent nearly his entire adult life advocating for different environmental initiatives. So no longer involved with Greenpeace directly, but that hasn't stopped him from standing up for different environmental issues. So in this interview, Rod talks a bit about his early activist years before Greenpeace, actually founding Greenpeace, which involved fighting nuclear testing and Arctic oil drilling, and some of the dangers he faced while protesting. He also has a rather interesting story about how he and other Greenpeace members tried to expose government moles that infiltrated the organization back in the 70s. So here's that interview with Rod.
My name is Rod Merning. I'm an environmentalist. I'm chair of the BC Environmental Network. I'm constantly trying to save the planet. And I'm a co-founder of Greenpeace.
So where did your interest in environmental activism first start?
Oh, my God. I grew up in the East End, Vancouver. And back in those days, it wasn't that long ago. But, you know, you had a lot of trees in the East End, Vancouver. It used to be 66-foot lots. And then the city council said, oh, we're going to make 33-foot lots out of 66-foot lots. And so the trees started coming down all around my neighborhood.
And that was just based on the increasing density and population of Vancouver.
Yeah, just an increasing density of Vancouver. Not only that, where the highway is, you know, as you go into that tunnel, as you head over to North Shore, there was a mushroom farm, and there was horses, and there was creeks all through there, and there was crayfish, and there was rabbits, and there was a whole beautiful wonderland for kids, you know. And then, it all radically changed from when I was between 4 and 12 years old. At 8 years, there was just a radical change in that neighborhood, and it affected me. And I think was the beginning.
Yeah, Greenpeace is known for its politically rebellious acts. Do you remember what your first politically rebellious act was as a teenager?
Yeah. I was. My dad was going to chop down a tree, and I went into his workshop, and I took his axe. And I threw it over the cliff, and I didn't tell anybody. And he kept saying, "Have you seen my axe?" And I said, "No, I haven't seen it around." And it was that was a beginning. And I have to say, you know, I was a lucky guy, and I wanted to tell young men, I guess young boys, at one point you have to break away from your father, basically. And I was lucky because I grew up with a stepfather. My stepfather, my mom and dad married when I was about 3 or 4 years old. And so I knew that, you know, my father was not my hereditary father. And that gave me that arm's length distance. And I think that that's really important because I finally met my real father when I was about 40 years old. You say, oh, what's happening? I know you have these, you know, I have three half brothers, and then you have two half sisters, and you know he had five kids after he had me, and I says, well, what are these three? What are your three sons doing? He says, oh, they're all electricians, just like I am.
Yeah,
I mean. You know, you are, if fathers can control their kids, and mothers, too, can control their daughters, there's a lot of control going on. And if you really want to find out what your soul is made of, you have to branch out and be your own person.
So you thought it was easier to find your own sense of independence, your own sense of self, because you were aware that this person, one of the people that is raising me, is not my biological
father.
Yeah,
and I guess I had the courage, a little bit more courage, you know. Like this is one of my actions I did when I was young. There was two full city blocks, and pretty well downtown Vancouver. It's the entrance to Stanley Park.
Okay.
And I said, well, I'm gonna make it into a park. And he laughed at me, and he says, you know, listen, it's private property. Back in those days,
I believe, you know, I read about this. It was they were gonna develop that area of Stanley Park, cut down the trees.
Yeah.
So how old are you at this point?
I was 20 years old.
20 years old.
And I said, well, I've done a couple of campaigns now, and I feel like I can take on this thing, and as I'm big enough, you know. And he totally laughed. He says, listen, you know, I build buildings, you know, and I know there's just no way you're going to be able to pull this off. I says, well, watch me. And so I and Paul Watson, we were the two principal people that went in into that area. There was, about $250,000 12-foot-high cedar fence around the whole perimeter, two city blocks. And Paul said, made an announcement in Georgia Strait that he's going to go in and tear the fence down. And he said, I'm going to do it at 1 o'clock Friday. So everyone be there and watch me tear the fence down with my bare hands. So it came out, and he had a crowbar with him, and the police were right there. I mean, they actually had the paddy wagon waiting for him to do it. And, you know, so he walks up the fence, takes his crowbar, and he starts prying the fence. And he gets one plank off the fence and falls down on the sidewalk. And the police grab him, and they arrest him, and they throw him in the back of the paddy wagon, and then they head out. And I'm sitting across the street, a safe distance away, with about 200 people or 100 people just watching this whole thing come out. And the police drove off, and I said, okay, here's our chance. So we walked in there, went through the hole in the fence.
And was that planned, or was that just...
That was planned. I think that we were planning to do that.
So distraction and then entrance.
Yeah. And then, so we got in there, and we had, it was quite remarkable. We got inside the fence, and we started planting a park. We had all these donations. It was planned. I know it was planned, because we had a whole bunch of things already lined up. And, one was we had a flat bed truck that had brought in all kinds of flowers and plants and shrubs there was a nursery that was sort of closing down. We got a lot of donations from them. And so we started planting inside this construction zone, this park. And and then it grew from there. I actually called in a bulldozer that came in and molded. I hired a bulldozer. And the guy says, do you own this property? I said, oh, yes. My dad is one of the people that owned the property. I was totally lying at the time. But he was surprised that I had, you know, I could open up the construction gate and let him in.
Didn't ask to see any paperwork.
No. He just came in, and he created a big pond in the area, like a big hole basically. And then we took all the dirt from the hole and made hills and in a little pathway through, and that was landscaping this flat area into a kind of a park, into a garden. And we got a load of topsoil thrown in there too, We just went at it. And
yeah, I remember I was reading a story online written by one of the other co-founders of Greenpeace, who I believe was a bit older than you at the time. And from what I read, this was a stunt that got you recognized people that were maybe a little bit more your senior in the environmental activism scene in Vancouver.
Yeah, it did. It actually, up to then, I was a pretty crazy kind of radical yippie, they called me at the time, because I was involved in a street theater group called Rocky Rococo and his Rococo Delights. And so we did street theater, and then we started branching into political street theater, and then we did briefs at City Hall and stuff like that. So,
good morning, Vietnam! Hey, this is not a test. This is rock and roll. Time to rock it from the Delta to the DMZ. Is that me, or does that sound like an Elvis Presley movie? Viva Da Nang. Oh, viva Da Nang. Da Nang me, why don't they get a rope and hang me? Hey, is it a little too early for being that loud? Hey, too late. It's 0600. What's the O stand for? Oh, my God, it's early. Speaking of early, picture a man going on a journey beyond sight and sound. He's left Crete. He's entered the demilitarized zone. What is a demilitarized zone? Sounds like something out of the Wizard of Oz.
Oh, no, don't go in there.
Oh, hee-ho, Ho Chi Minh.
Oh, look, you've landed in Saigon. You're among the little people now.
We represent the Arvern Army, Oh, no, follow the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Follow the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Oh, I'll get you, my pretty! Oh, my God, it's the Wicked Witch of the North. It's Hanoi Hannah! Now, little G.I., you and your little toodoo, too!
Ah! Adrian. What are you doing, Adrian?
Oh, Hannah, you slut. You've been on everything but the Titanic. Stop it right now. I'm melting! Well, my pretty old... But hey, here's some little advice. Don't eat at a restaurant located next to a pound. So let's check in the field now. Hey, hi, can you help me? What's your name? My name's Roosevelt Lee Roosevelt. Roosevelt, what town are you stationed in? I'm stationed in Poon Tang. Well, thank you, Roosevelt. What's the weather like out there? It's hot. Damn hot. Real hot. Hotter than this is my shorts. I can cook things in it. Little crotch pot cooking. Well, can you tell me what it feels like? Fool, it's hot. I told you again. Were you born on the sun? It's damn hot. You can be a little thing. I saw it so damn hot. I saw one of those little guys in the orange robe burst into flames. It's that hot. You know what I'm talking about. What do you think it's going to be like tonight? It's going to be hot and wet. That's nice if you're with a lady, but it ain't no good if you're in the jungle. Thank you, Roosevelt. Here's a song coming your way right now. Nowhere to Run To by Martha and the Vandellas. Yes!
And now back to David Michael Swanson interviewing Greenpeace co-founder Rod Marinie.
So you were mentioning that you were in political street theater.
Yeah.
So, and you integrated your theater background into your activist work with Greenpeace. So how does theatrics lend itself to creating change through protest?
Well, you know, I mean, I've been talking about Pauli Mines this morning on another radio show, and it's a dry topic, you know. It's not, but when you mesh it with telling a story, it's a whole different ballgame. You can, when you tell a story, it's interesting. It becomes like a continuing series. And then the more you dress it up, the better the story becomes. And when you you know, like, for example, I you know, sailing into a nuclear test zone, that was one of the projects that I was working on. And so by putting, you know, 12 guys and sailing and putting on a ship and sailing it right into a nuclear test area, you're going to have drama.
And people become interested, people watching on television at home,
yeah.
If it, or reading
oh,
the papers,
yes.
They become interested in the people that are doing this. So you start to develop your
Especially,
own character, the eyes of the reader or the listener.
The drama basically is that ideally put a lot of media people on a ship that sails into a nuclear test zone. There's a lot of drama there because you don't, you know, should we get any closer? No, I don't want to die. I want to go back home. So you're creating a show. Everybody loves a show, and that way you can continue it day after day after day, and it's like a series, a TV series, and then people want to tune in the next day, or they want to buy a newspaper and say, what's the latest? You know, have the guys got killed yet, you know?
And at the very least, the goal of that is just to show people what's happening. Whether they choose to care about it or not is their decision, but the first step, I would imagine, is just presenting something that you think is important enough for people to know about on a mass level, right?
Yeah. And telling stories about it, what's going on, and you want to kind of hit the social media, basically. And the social media back in those days was cocktail parties and everything, you know, people having a beer with your friends.
So Greenpeace is now an internationally recognized environmental rights organization, offices in 50 countries. So tell me how it all started, because you are a co-founder, so you were there from the beginning. How did it start?
Well, it just started from our actions. You know, there was the group of us that wanted to go to Amchitka nuclear test zone, and we sailed the ship into nuclear test zone.
Whereabouts is that?
That's Amchitka is on the Alaskan Panhandle, and it's at the end of the Alaskan Panhandle, and it's a good 2 weeks sailing from here. It took a while to get there.
So Vancouver seems to naturally be an environmentally conscious city, and I would think that the city's geography, the fact that we are surrounded by such a rich, vivid environment, has something to do with this mindset. But what other aspects of a city or a community do you think help generate a social movement, environmental or otherwise?
Well, you know, you got a situation in Vancouver where East meets West, so you have two consciousness colliding in the Eastern philosophy, Eastern ways of doing things, Eastern ways of thinking, and you mesh it with Western philosophy. And, you know, I had a Brahmin priest come and live with me for a while, and we could basically merge two cultures together really quickly, and I think that helped. I used to think Vancouver was the frontier of human consciousness. You know, we were riding the crest of this wave that was moving through humanity, and we were experimenting, you know, like a surfer does on a crest of a wave. We were media savvy. There was never a culture on the planet that had TV when they were 2 or 3 years old. So we were plugged in.
Yeah, and you were talking about earlier Greenpeace's first voyage, but Greenpeace's first ship in its fleet was called the Rainbow Warrior, which I absolutely love the name of that. Mm-hmm. The ship, which was bombed in 1985, helped end nuclear testing in the Pacific, you were mentioning, mm-hmm. Blocked coal ports, it closed down destructive fishing operations. But I'd like to hear more about this boat and what it meant as a symbol of Greenpeace.
Bob got a little book, and it was called Warriors of the Rainbow, and he passed it around to everyone, and we got copies, found out more copies on the, and we And this book was about a Native legend, and the legend was that when, you know, we were heading into this amazing collapse of the planet, and when this collapse would happen, then all the warriors, all the different races on the planet would be very similar. They would start to think like the First Nations on this planet, to respect the Earth, and that whole Native philosophy would permeate all the races on the planet, and they would come together and save the planet. We adopted the book. And so the Warriors of the Rainbow became the Rainbow Warrior. By the time I got back to Vancouver, and I was about 22 now, we got back to Vancouver. We had some money left over from all the money we had raised in the Amchitka voyage. And I said, okay, let's head down to Roraima Island and take on the French nuclear testing.
And whereabouts is that?
That's in the South Pacific. I placed an ad in the paper, in the Auckland Star and the Canterbury News and a number of newspapers at the time, wanting somebody to have a had sailboat that was willing to sail into a nuclear test zone. And I was shocked that we got about 100 applications.
Wow.
And one that sort of stood out, you know, at the time was this guy that was was in jail, and he was a Canadian. He had the best boat. He had a 36-foot catch.
Do you know why he was in jail?
Yes. He was smuggling Rolex watches from the Philippines or someplace and into New Zealand, and they found out and they put him in jail. So he was sitting in jail, and he said, "Listen, I've been at sea for many, many years. Please give me something to read." And at the time, the jail guard walked over and grabbed a newspaper and then threw it underneath his cell door. And it landed at his feet, and there was the ad right there. And that's my ticket out of here, because at least we would pay his bail. He had no money, and he had to wait 3 months before his trial. And so he made the contact and said, "Listen, I got the best boat. I'm Canadian, you know, hire me." And so we went down there, and he said, "I need $50,000. And I said, "Oh, well, that's interesting." And I says, "Well, this is the facts, and you know, we have you're going to be able to get your ship outfitted with this, and we can give you $2,000, and that's it." And then he says, "This is no way. I'm going to risk my ship in a nuclear test zone and
still be in jail."
Yeah, I'll stay in jail. You know, I said, "Okay, goodbye." And then he changed his tune right after. I said, "No, okay,
yeah,
let me out of here." So we had him basically, and that's how we got into Roraima.
I feel like the boat is a very prominent symbol of Greenpeace. So why do you think the boat is such a active and vivid symbol? Why does it sort of register in people's minds so clearly?
Well, the boat is a stage. I knew right from the beginning, you know, the whole world is a stage in a sense. But when you confine it into a small little area, it becomes quite interesting to see the dynamics unfold. And so the world is made up of 3-mile limit, a 12-mile limit, and a 200-mile limit. And so once you go beyond the 12-mile limit, there are certain things you can do. And then when you go beyond the 200-mile limit, there's no law. It's a Wild West out there.
So, and that was something that you were aware of beforehand. Yeah. So you knew that you could have a little bit more freedom with protesting.
Yeah. And so there was limits. I mean, we set rules down in Greenpeace. And those rules were, don't mess with the man, basically. Don't harm any property. Be very peaceful. But there was another faction in Greenpeace at the time, and myself being one of them, that supported reinventing yourself all the time and always pushing the limits, always keep going and seeing how far you can push it. Not be violent, but there's a lot of gray area there that you can push. And so Greenpeace rammed a lot of ships, you know. I don't know if, you know, they'll say, "Well, we didn't do it on purpose," but that's their way out of it.
Greenpeace and activist organizations, they're known for organizing demonstrations that could result in members receiving legal punishment or even physical harm. Mm-hmm. You know, ramming a boat, that could result in some people being on board, actually hurting themselves or hurting somebody else on the other boat, or at the very least, there could be legal ramifications for that. So were you ever in a situation when you were with Greenpeace where there was the very real potential of you going to jail for a long period of time or having physical harm inflicted upon yourself?
Oh, yeah. You know, you... When we were going to Amchit, our plan was to go right into the territory. I mean, we're talking sitting within a few miles of the test zone. You're going to get, if the bomb goes off, you're dead.
Be prepared. That's the Boy Scouts' marching song. Be prepared. As through life you march along, be prepared to hold your liquor pretty well. Don't write naughty words on walls if you can't spell. Be prepared to hide that pack of cigarettes. Don't make book if you cannot cover bets. Keep those reefers hidden where you're sure that they will not be found. And be careful not to smoke them when the scoutmaster's around, for he only will insist that they be shared. Be prepared. Be prepared. That's the Boy Scout's solemn creed. Be prepared. And be clean in word and deed. Don't solicit for your sister. That's not nice. Unless you get a good percentage of her price. Be prepared. And be careful not to do your good deeds when there's no one watching you. If you're looking for adventure of a new and different kind, and you come across a Girl Scout who is similarly inclined, don't be nervous, don't be flustered, don't be scared. Be prepared.
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.